following presentation was recorded live by Voices from Jerusalem.
Today we're going to do is a very significant period of time, if not depressing, in Jewish history, which is the Great Revolt. Which we're going to go through all of basically a period of about 70 years, a little more, 100 years, from the time of Herod until the end of the Second Temple period. Again, keeping in mind, in terms of patterns in history, that we still live in the diaspora caused by the Second Revolt. So this is an especially important period of time to pay attention to, because the causes of the destruction of the Second Temple, on a spiritual level we're talking about, not the direct physical causes, Rome's gone, but the real reason from the Jewish perspective as to why the temple was destroyed still haunts us today. And I think it'll become very clear when we go through this period of time that we're exactly in the same situation. And we definitely have what to learn from by studying this period of time in history. Last week when we left off, we talked about Rome coming to Israel again around the year 63 with Pompey. This is again the end of the transition, the last couple of decades when Rome is still a republic until it's going to go into the empire ruled by different Caesars. Year 37. I made a slight mistake, I realized. I said 27. Year 37 BCE is a significant year for two reasons. That is the year when Augustus Caesar, remember I went through last class, this whole struggle for power. We're talking about different people fighting, right? We have Caesar, and Caesar is murdered. We have the struggle for power with eventually ending up with Mark Antony fighting Octavian. Mark Antony, his girlfriend Cleopatra, again, see that movie? At the Battle of Actium, they lose. Mark Antony and Cleopatra commit suicide, and Augustus, or at that time Octavian, is the unrivaled leader of Rome. Okay. Now, during this time, what's going on in Israel? We already talked about Antipater and his son Herod. At this period of time, by the way, the Parthians, the Persians, also invade the land of invade the eastern part of the Roman Empire, and the Jews rise up in support of the Persians in hope of getting the Romans out. Herod flees. Okay, Herod's nominally in charge of the Galilee in Israel. He flees for his life. He actually, during the fighting between Antony, Cleopatra, and Octavian, Herod had aligned himself with Mark Antony. Bad move, you know. Herod is one of the most wily political people in Jewish political history. He manages to always come out on top. Remarkably uncanny sense of how to manipulate people. He basically presents himself to Augustus, I believe it's in Cyprus. He sort of throws himself at his mercy. You know, because really he should be killed for siding with the wrong side. He obviously did a good amount of double talking and talked his way out of a difficult situation, because not only is his life spared, but Augustus, this is again the year 37, just as Augustus is coming to power, he makes Herod basically the king of the land of Israel. He gives him complete control as a proxy king, as a puppet king of the land of Israel. And this is going to begin a very long period of Herodian rule, which is going to go till the year 4. Okay, so we're talking about he's going to reign for decades as the unrivaled ruler of the land of Israel, and a person who leaves a very significant mark on the land of Israel. For those of you guys who travel around the country, you'll see that Herod's remains are probably the most significant archaeological remains in the land of Israel. Most of what we know about Herod comes from more or less one source, which is the source I've mentioned several times before, Flavius Josephus. Right? Josephus, or we call him IBM, Yosef ben Matityahu, who was the leader, as I mentioned before, of the defense of the Galilee during the Great Revolt, who later is going to surrender to the Romans and going to become the chronicler of the revolt. He has, again, he wrote several important works. One of them is Antiquities, and specifically we're going to look at today, I'm going to read you a couple of quotes from It's the Jewish War, where he chronicles all the events taking place before, during, and after the Great Revolt against Rome from the years about 66 till the year 70. Which is unique as a historical account because he's alive during the time. It's not like Roman historians, people like Deo Cassius, who live later and are merely repeating what they've read from previous records. He's actually an eyewitness to the events, albeit he definitely gives a specific slant to things. But you can't understand this period of time without reading Josephus. He's a must-read. When you read Josephus, he's one of the most enigmatic people to try and figure out, you know, where he's coming from. Biblical Archaeology Review did a very interesting article on Josephus a couple of years ago. Like, what hat's he wearing? He's wearing a Roman hat. He's wearing... Because he obviously, on one hand, he's a Kohen. He's loyal to Judaism his whole life. He never becomes a pagan or anything like that. But on the other hand, he's adopted by the Roman royal family, and he's used by them as a translator and ultimately the chronicler of the wars. So he's trying to sort of please everyone at the same time. It's obviously in his best interest, when he describes the revolt, to make the Jews seem as macho a fighting force as possible for two reasons. One, he's definitely a proud Jew. But also, it reflects better on the Romans to defeat a great enemy. Okay, so by making the battle seem intense and by making Titus and Vespasian out there wading their way through the gore, it obviously makes them look good, and they'll be happy with him. So when you read Josephus, you have to read him very cautiously and very critically. People will debate for all time what's accurate and what's not. Just the last word, it's not a class on Josephus, but one thing that when you do read him, one thing pretty much everyone agrees on is his remarkable level of accuracy concerning the physical descriptions of things in the land of Israel. Okay, what he describes, places he describes, buildings, projects he built. Why do we know them to be accurate? Because we now, you know, millennium later, dig up these places and we see that the way Josephus describes it is essentially correct. So he's definitely given the benefit of the doubt. If he describes something that hasn't been found, we assume it's there and just not found yet. For instance, a theater in Jerusalem. We speculate where it is. We haven't found it yet, but we assume it was here somewhere. The Romans built a theater. One thing he's definitely not accurate on when you read his things, as all ancient historians are famous for not being accurate on, is, anyone think they can guess? What's the thing? Sorry, not the Ark of the Covenant. He doesn't even talk about it. What's the big thing that historians are notorious in the ancient world for exaggerating? Numbers of people. Numbers of people. Always. You can slash all these guys' numbers by more than half to get the right number of people. Okay? So we have, but that's not a Josephus thing. That's an everyone does this. Okay, he says 1.5 million people died, and there wasn't that many people living in the whole country at the time, you know. So that's the way they speak. So if you're reading Josephus, and I highly recommend you read him, just read him cautiously and critically. Okay, but it's a must read. I've seen a couple copies floating around already. People are taking me seriously and buying copies. Okay, so just to go back to the history and then talk a little bit about Herod and his building projects, which are very, very significant. Again, we say, during the period of time when Rome comes to Israel from 63, with two breaks. There's only two breaks when Israel is going to be ruled by a puppet king. One is during the reign of Herod, 37 BCE till 4, and the second is during the reign of the grandson of Herod, a man by the name of Agrippus I, okay, who rules from 44 of the common era to about 41, 3 years, and then, of course, being a competent person, he's murdered, as in most people in the ancient world. That aside, Israel is going to be ruled for this entire period of time, as I mentioned before, by Roman procurators and proconsuls. A proconsul is going to be the guy who rules the vast territorial area based in Syria. That's where they sit. And the procurators are going to be the local administrators who are going to usually reside in a city built by Herod himself called Caesarea Maritima, okay, which is the Roman capital of Israel. And again, these are people who are not very nice people. Usually they're very cruel and oppressive. It's important to understand that because much of what we understand to be what leads up to the revolt is going to be exacerbated by the attitude of these Roman leaders, people like Felix, Florus, Pontius Pilate, who again, if you read Josephus, he's very clear that these guys were cruel and very greedy. And when you get to a guy like Florus, who's going to be the last procurator before the Great Revolt, Josephus basically paints the picture that he deliberately incites the Jews to revolt, basically to save his skin. And we get to the actual revolt, I'll talk a little bit more about that. Okay, but just to talk a little bit about Herod now. I mean, the picture we get of Herod the Great, as he's called, not to be confused, because there are lots of people who take the name Herod. Not Herod Antipas, who's in the New Testament, he's governor of the Galilee, descendant of Herod, but Herod the Great, the guy who rules from 37 until 4. The picture we get from him is primarily from Josephus and a little bit from Jewish sources like the Talmud, and it's not a very good picture. Okay, Herod is sort of painted as, I like to use the terminology, the Joseph Stalin of the Jewish people. Okay, someone who ruled with absolute authority. If you're familiar with Stalin, you know he was a very brutal person. As, you know, they say that the Germans, you know, the Russians took something like 20 million plus casualties in World War II. They estimate that Stalin killed actually more people in his gulags, in his camps. 25 million people or so disappeared. A vicious person, paranoid to the extreme. Stalin killed members of his own family. Stalin's also known for being a tremendous builder. If you go to Moscow today, you see they have these big Stalin Gothic buildings. They're really ugly, like neoclassical Slavic, Soviet-style buildings. Herod's sort of the same way. The picture we get of him is being a person who is in absolute control, a person who's incredibly paranoid, a person who murders tremendous number of his own family members and crushes any opposition to him ruthlessly. Josephus gives great detail as to all the people he murders and how they're murdered. It's really gruesome. And also a man of tremendous talent in terms of as an administrator and as a builder. Certainly, Herod's building projects are some of the most famous building projects on the planet Earth. As a matter of fact, if they hadn't closed the list of like the seven wonders of the ancient world much earlier, before Herod's time, that list was closed, Herod would have had half the list just in the land of Israel, because almost all archaeologists and students of architecture of the ancient world appreciate that he is certainly one of the greatest builders of all human history. Now, why was he able to build? He's able to build so much because when he is ruler, for all the bad things you can say about Herod, he definitely is a practical man and doesn't want to antagonize his people. He has very good relations with the Romans. He has their complete support. He's given control of a large area of territory. He controls Israel, sits, as I mentioned before, on all the major trade routes. Therefore, everything's moving through here. Lots of money in taxes, lots of middlemen, right? The great Jewish business, right? Middlemen. And cash crops in the ancient world were, what were the big cash crops in the ancient world? Anyone know? Olive oil. Okay, oil, which was used for main source of light, not just for cooking, not just for, you know, like, you know, today it's for your heart. You drink, eat olive oil, you know, low in saturated fats. Dates, which are the main sweetener in the ancient world before sugar. Sugar wasn't around at this period of time. From the sugar comes from a totally different part of the world much later in history. Dates, which, you know, the honey from dates, also the major sweetener. Okay, there's all kinds of stuff. And again, all the spices coming from Yemen and all that stuff. So Israel had there's a lot of cash in the country. There was a lot of stability. Okay, it might have been a quasi-police state, but there was definitely a lot of stability. And Herod's going to use all that income and the backing of the Romans and also make use of all the tremendous Roman architectural and engineering ability to build some of the most amazing sites in the land of Israel. And I'm sure all of you, if you've been here for a while, you probably visited most of them. Just to name a few of them, we have Sebaste up in the north, which is no longer a ruin today. That was the capital of the northern part of the country. He rebuilds that city. He builds the largest port, artificial port, okay, in the Mediterranean world, okay, the largest port in the Roman Empire, which is a huge building project, which takes him over a decade to build, Caesarea Maritima, or Sebastos, named after Augustus Caesar, which, anyone to Caesarea, it's between Tel Aviv and Haifa on the coast. He builds a giant artificial jetty and a port, incredible feat of engineering, complete with huge blocks. He made waterproof concrete, which he sunk in, builds a huge jetty on it. On the jetty, he had, like, you know, restaurants and hostels, you name it. He built it there. A huge temple to Augustus Caesar, because they, of course, deified all these emperors even while they were alive. This is going to become the Roman capital of the land of Israel. It's going to symbolize, in Jewish eyes, everything that which is pagan and Roman and antithetical to everything that which is Judaism. Caesarea Maritima. Okay? You can go visit. It's one of the most interesting archaeological sites. It's got everything. It's got a beautiful theater in there. It's got an amphitheater, you know, a hippodrome for the chariot races like in Ben-Hur, that stuff. Bathhouses, you name it, it's there. Incredible feat of engineering. Herod is known also as, you know, as a builder. He's a person who really was very revolutionary. He creates things that he builds an artificial mountain not far from here in the south, a place called Herodium. Have you been to Herodium? Artificial mountain fortress. The second largest palace in the ancient world was completed. Tremendous, tremendous feat of engineering. Okay, it was destroyed at the end of the Great Revolt in 70. It was a stronghold for the zealots who were hanging out against the Romans. He's buried there, by the way, Herod, and according to Josephus. He's buried somewhere outside the artificial mountain. Masada, he builds in the middle of nowhere on top of a mesa, a platform, a beautiful palace. Gore, he builds palaces everywhere. Okay. Beautiful palace in the middle of nowhere, tremendous feat of engineering, especially the northern part of the palace, complete with all the creature comforts in a desert, had incredible water supply system, agriculture on top, baths, you name it, amazing view, fantastic climate, unbelievable place. By the way, it's not as original. The site was used previously by the Hasmoneans. He builds a beautiful palace in Jericho. Okay, which is where he actually dies. Okay, Jericho, that's his favorite place to hang out. Beautiful springs, lovely weather, even in the winter. He diverts the water from Wadi Kelt to run through his palace. Again, if you appreciate ancient engineering and architecture, Herod is the man. Most impressive of all, and probably to ingratiate himself with his countrymen who hated his guts, he spends a huge amount of money and effort rebuilding the city of Jerusalem, the walls around it, and especially rebuilding the Temple Mount and the temple itself. Now, the second temple, which is rebuilt by the Jews returning from Babylon, is going to be remodeled a number of times. One, when it's first rebuilt, you know, Nehemiah, when the Jews come back from the exile in Babylon, the Maccabees are going to do some work on the temple site itself, and Herod is going to actually redo the whole site. and make it the largest cult site. When I say cult, I don't mean religious. I mean cult in terms of a site for religious practice on the planet Earth. Now, I want to describe just this from, Josephus again. This is his, he's describing here the rebuilding of the temple. Accordingly, in the 15th year of his reign, Herod rebuilt the temple and encompassed a piece of land about it with a wall, enlarging the surrounding area to double its former extent. The expenses he devoted to it were incalculable, and its riches were unspeakable. A sign of this you have in the great colonnades that are erected upon the temple, and the citadel which was upon the north side. Okay, he's talking about a colonnade built right opposite this window you're looking out now, the Royal Stoa, and the Antonia Fortress. The colonnade he built for the foundations, but the citadel he repaired at tremendous expense in a style in no way inferior to that of the royal palace, and he called it Antonia in honor of Anthony. Okay? He also built himself a palace in the upper city containing two very large and most beautiful apartments to which the temple itself could not be compared in size. One apartment he named Caesareum and the other Agrippium for his two great friends. Okay, so he builds sort of Jerusalem as a sort of a bipolar city. We have on this part in the east, you have sort of, I saw the Jewish part of the city, the temple and the Antonia Fortress and the walls around it, and up near Jaffa Gate today, as a matter of fact, underneath what is David's Tower, which has nothing to do with King David, by the way, where, of course, as most places in Israel, many of them are misnamed, especially where people are buried. But he builds a beautiful palace with different towers named after friends and family, Hippicus, Faisal. Again, if you read, Josephus describes more the whole the palace, tremendous builder. The walls are never completed in his lifetime. The walls are much larger than the walls of the city they are today. Most archaeologists, again, there's a certain amount of guesswork, assume the walls go down into the south here, into what is Silwan, and to the north, they go all the way up to, they found pieces of the wall up by the Russian compound and the U.S. consulate over North Jerusalem. Okay, in East Jerusalem, but to the north of the old city. So a huge, massive fortifications, huge blocks of stone, similar to what's built in the Kotel. And of course, most importantly of all, as Josephus describes, he spends a huge amount of effort. Takes 10,000 men 10 years just to build the retaining walls around the Temple Mount, which is what you see today. The western wall is merely part of that 500-meter-long retaining wall that was designed to build a platform on top so that you could stick a structure on top of it. And it's huge. You could fit 12 football fields up there. It's the world's largest man-made platform. I believe even until today, it is still the world's largest man-made platform. Again, the most largest religious site on the planet Earth. It says in the Mishnah, if you haven't seen the house of Herod, you haven't seen a house. And they're not talking about his condo in Caesarea. They're talking about the temple in Jerusalem, which was significantly larger than the one you look out the window here today, much larger. Much larger. The retaining walls, much higher. Most of them, the upper part was knocked down by the Romans in the year 70. And the temple itself stood, if you look at the gold dome, and the very top, the little like moon sticking up on there on the top of the gold dome, the temple itself was another 40 feet higher in height, estimated, than the gold dome. So we're talking about a massive site. One of the largest structures in the ancient world. Certainly would have been one of the wonders of the ancient world if it had been completed earlier. Yes, sir?
Was it done by slave labor? Was it done by
Almost all historians agree it was not done by slave labor. It was done by... Herod had a lot of money. He paid workers to do it. Matter of fact, if any of you are familiar with... This has nothing to do with the Second Temple, but the Freemasons. You know the Freemasons? Secret society for male bonding? According to tradition, the Freemasons... It just shows you... It's related to the idea of voluntary work... Are the Masons, they base their heritage on the idea that they descend from the original stonemasons brought by King Solomon to build the first temple. So it's interesting, this idea that it was not slave labor. People like to say that, to make Herod look even worse. How he moved the huge blocks of stone, which weigh on average 4 to 40 tons, and if you go on the tunnel tour, you'll see there are stones in there. There's a stone there that weighs over 560 metric tons. It weighs like 600 tons, in American tons. That's an incredible piece of rock. Can you imagine moving that into place? Can you imagine dropping it on your toe? How did he do it? That's a whole separate talk. I don't want to spend my whole class talking about Herod's engineering feats, but they are very, very spectacular. And even people who don't like Herod, like Josephus, begrudgingly give him a lot of credit for doing the impossible in terms of engineering, creating these massive sites. Why did the temple have to be so large? Why such a huge platform? Again, I explained last class that Jews in the Roman Empire 2,000 years ago were a huge number of Jews. We're talking 7 to 8 million Jews could have been. And on Passover, Shavuos, and Sukkot, hundreds of thousands of people would come back to the land of Israel for Olei Regel, for the pilgrimage. If you were here 2,000 years ago on Passover, you would see the whole area around Jerusalem, tents, people camping everywhere, thousands of people coming up to the Temple Mount, especially on Passover when you had to bring your Korban Pesach. your Paschal lamb, and you'd see you have to have a very large platform to accommodate such a huge number of people. Okay, today it's all gone except for the lower part of the retaining wall, which was literally too massive to destroy. They just left it there, and the rest was built over by the Muslims. We'll get to them later. Okay, so that's Herod. Okay, now again, just to show you on his negative side, he marries, as I mentioned, he had more than one wife, but one of his favorite wife is Miriam. Miriam is a descendant of the Hasmoneans, the last one we know of more or less, she and her children. He marries her to get legitimacy. He loved her and he was insanely jealous of her, and as we're going to see, he's going to have her murdered. And I want to describe, again, just a couple more passages from Josephus. I think he says it very nicely. Listen to this. It's very interesting. He says, of the five children which Herod had by Miriam, two of them were daughters and three were sons. The youngest of these sons was educated in Rome and died there. But the two eldest he treated as those of royal blood on account of the nobility of their mother, and because they were not born until he was king. But what was stronger than all this was his love he bore for Miriam, which inflamed him every day to great degree, and so far conspired with the other motives that he was insensitive to the troubles of which his beloved was the cause. For Miriam's hatred of him was as great as his love for her. She had indeed just cause for indignation because of what he had done, while her boldness proceeded from his affections for her. So he openly reproached him for what he had done to her grandfather Hyrcanus and to her brother Aristobulus. He had murdered all the other members of her family. Can you imagine that? This is not a great marriage here. Like, I killed, like, although he did get the bump off his mother-in-law, but, you know, yeah, but yes, but it's unbelievable. But he's crazy about it. It's very interesting, the relationship here. For he had not spared this Aristobulus, though he was but of youth. For although he had given him the high priesthood, this is Miriam's brother, he made him high priest, a descendant of the Hasmoneans. People love this guy. Okay, though he had given him the high priesthood at the age of 17, he killed him quickly after that, and he conferred that dignity upon after he conferred that dignity upon him. When Aristobulus had put on the holy vestments and approached the altar at a festival, the multitude and the great crowd fell into tears. Thereupon the youth was sent by night to Jericho and was plunged there by the Gauls at Herod's command into a pool until he drowned. Meaning he's made at 17 high priest. The people go crazy over him because he's legitimate. He's one of the Hasmoneans. He's a real Cohen, you know, of stature. So what does Herod have him do? He takes him, he ostensibly invites him to a little pool party in which he's held under the water until he dies. Okay, and this is what he does to all of his own children from that relationship. Now, to end the story, of course, it says this is what happens to Miriam. Now, at one point he has to leave the land of Israel, and he leaves word that if something happens to him, Miriam should be murdered, you know? She shouldn't go living on without him. And she finds out about this, and she's not too happy. So here's what happens. When he heard that his grand secret was revealed, he was besides himself, and he said that Joseph would never have disclosed this injunction of him unless he had debauched her. Now he's going to accuse her of cheating. His passion also made him stark mad, and leaping out of his bed, he ran around the palace in a wild manner. His sister Salome took the opportunity also to slander Miriam and to confirm his suspicions about Joseph. Then out of his ungovernable jealousy and rage, he commanded both of them to be killed immediately. But as soon as his passion was over, he repented of what he had done, and as soon as his anger was worn off, his affections were kindled again. Too late, unless you're into necrophilia here, I mean. Indeed, the flame of his desires for her was so ardent that he could not think she was dead. But he would appear under his disorders to speak to her as if she were still alive, until time taught him the reality of his loss, when his grief appeared as great as his affection had been for her while she was still living. This is not a real stable guy. Okay, but not a guy you want to get. As a matter of fact, the rumor has it that he had her embalmed and kept her in like a giant jar, you know. Who knows? Pretty sick guy. But again, yeah, he's like one of those guys, you know, who obviously had too much lead in his drinking pipes or something. No joke. The Romans used lead in a lot of their piping, and historians actually think a lot of the insanity in the Roman world was caused by lead poisoning.
Yeah, the women used lipstick; they had like lead, and a lot
of that caused. If you read, now by the way, this reads like, you know, this reads better than Melrose or Dallas, but if you read. This is by no means unusual. Go read Suetonius, The Lives of the Twelve Caesars, and you'll see, he's a historian writing about it. You want to see dysfunctional families. You look at the Roman royal families during the reigns of, you know, Augustus, Tiberius, Claudius, Caligula, all these guys. You're talking like wacko. It's amazing the Roman Empire was able to survive as long as it did, given the insanity and incompetence of many of the people running the country and the machinations and the murder and what was going on is incredible. So this is kind of like a normal story for the time. Just the end of this, of course, is that just to show you what a nice guy that Herod is, he declares on the day he died, he had 1,000 rabbis brought to the amphitheater in Jericho, and he commanded they should all be murdered on word of his death so the people would mourn rather than rejoice. Now, that was not carried out, but it shows you the kind of guy he was. Okay, so to be fair, you know, it wasn't a dark period of time of tremendous poverty. It was a period of time of stability and to a large extent affluence, but it was also a time when you had sort of a police state going on here. You had a man in power who, although he was smart enough, pragmatic enough, not to generally antagonize the Jewish people. If the Romans tried to do anything, they would have gotten the Jewish people going, like putting idols in the temple, Roman eagles, whatever. Herod was very quick to move in and get the Romans to chill out and calm down, because he knew if they revolt, it's going to be bad news for everyone. So he's very pragmatic in that respect. But he's also a man who openly sides with the Hellenists and the pagans and the Sadducees, the Sadducees, and is constantly at odds with the Pharisees, who are really the people who are in charge of the Jewish people. And again, just as in the story of Hanukkah, the majority of Jews are going to be in line with the Pharisees and keeping Torah, while a minority are going to be siding with Herod and the Gentile citizens. And the same tension we see in the Hanukkah story is going to be constantly in the land of Israel, because you're going to have these Greco-Roman pagans hanging out in places like Caesarea, okay, causing all kinds of problems. The Talmud says very clearly, very interesting statement, Caesarea and Jerusalem. Okay, if anyone tells you Jerusalem is standing and Caesarea is destroyed, believe them. If they tell you Caesarea is standing and Jerusalem is destroyed, believe them. If they tell you they're both standing, don't believe them. Now, we know for a fact, historically, that Caesarea and Jerusalem were around at the same time. When Herod was alive, he builds the city of Caesarea. He didn't destroy Jerusalem. He spent a lot of money building both places up. Beautiful sites. Okay. The point being made by the rabbis is obviously a theological, historical, political, cosmic sort of point about the reality of the relationship between Israel and Rome, between Jacob and Esau. But these are, again, just going back to the story, remember, of the going back all the way to Genesis, this rivalry, we're talking about two physically very unequal in terms of their strength. Israel is no match for Rome. But the battle is always viewed from Jewish sources as a cosmic struggle of who's going to be on top, both within the land of Israel and within history. Meaning you can't have one on top without the other being down. When the Jews are up and Jewish values are strong, then Roman values, right, are going to be down and so on. That's the cosmic struggle that's going to go on. Okay, so again, there's much more going on in terms of the Jewish perspective on the world. It's not merely a minor revolt. It's just a manifestation of what is going to be a very long historical struggle between values. Okay. Now, by the way, just to stop for a minute before we talk about the revolt, we're looking at the chain of transmission during this period of time. Because remember, at this period of time, all the normative institutions that were what was mainstream Judaism are more or less, some of them are still functioning, albeit not very good shape. Meaning, we have a king for some of the time, but he's certainly not a legitimate king. He's not from the house of King David. There is a Sanhedrin, but its powers are severely curtailed. Okay, there is a temple, but the high priest, as I mentioned before, there's over 300 high priests, Second Temple period. The office was bought. The position is almost always corrupted. So much of the normative institutions are not functional. The institution that's going to keep the Jewish people together are the rabbis in the chain of transmission. And I mentioned that we talking about the transmission process going from the men of the Great Assembly during the Babylonian exile to Shimon HaTzadik, to Antigonus Isocho, to the Zugot. We're talking about from 260 to 10 BCE, Jewish chronology, when you had five pairs of rabbis. Okay, who are going to serve. One is going to be the Av Beis Din, the head of the Sanhedrin, the administrator, and the other is going to be the Nasi, the president. The last pair of Zugot to live, who are going to rule at the beginning of the Common Era after Herod, but while the Second Temple is still standing, are Hillel and Shammai. Okay, Hillel, who comes from Babylon, very poor, by the way. The Talmud has interesting stories about how poor he is. So poor, you know, he couldn't even afford the couple of grushim that it cost the entrance fee to the base of Midrash, and he almost freezes to death while sitting on the skylights. You know, a man of tremendous nobility in terms of his yichus, but of incredible poverty, which is an interesting thing in Judaism. You know, you don't have to be rich to be in power. Okay, Hillel comes from Babylon, is going to assume the position of Nasi along with Shammai, who's going to be the Av Beis Din. And these are the last of the Zugot. These are the last pair until we get to the period of time from 10 BCE until 200, which is going to be the period of time of the Tanaim. Tana is the Aramaic word to teach. These are the guys who are going to put the Mishnah together. I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves and talk about the Mishnah yet. But it's very interesting. Hillel is considered by Jewish sources to be a tremendous person. I want to read you just a little quote from Sanhedrin 88b and from Sota 47b. It says, well, actually, no, this. Where's the quote about Hillel? Ah, here. Okay, excuse me. So this is Sukkah 20a. Originally, when Torah was in danger of being forgotten in Israel, Ezra went from Babel and reinforced it. The idea of coming up from Babylon to rejuvenate the Jewish community after the first exile. When it was once again, we're talking many years later, in danger of being forgotten, Hillel the Bavli went up and reinforced it. So we have, the Talmud views him as one of the great characters who strengthens Torah in the land of Israel. But on the other hand, we see that after Hillel and Shammai, we're going to have the first halachic disputes appearing. Remember I mentioned First Temple period? There are no disputes about Jewish law, so to speak. And if there are, they're easily decidable based on going to the high priest. He had his Urim V'Tumim breastplate that would light up. You had prophets. You could always ask for an answer from the original source. Through prophets, you can get it from God himself. Second Temple period, there's no prophecy. So we're relying on a transmission process, which we see is going to start fraying around the edges. It's very important if you want to understand the origins of disputes, like in the Talmud, thousands of pages of Talmud. On every page, the rabbis are arguing. It starts with the students of Hillel and Shammai. So this is Sanhedrin 88b or Sota 47b. It says, when the disciples of Shammai and Hillel, who did not serve their masters with full measure of intensity, increased halachic disputes increased in Israel, and the Torah appeared as two Torahs. Now, that's a very strong statement. It doesn't mean there was a huge schism and you had two different groups of Jews, like the Protestants and Catholics. This is not what's going on here. But we're talking about Beis Hillel, Beis Shammai. When it's the house of Hillel, the house of Shammai, which are the two schools. It doesn't mean like their houses were arguing, like two physical houses, but their groups of students are going to start to interpret Jewish law differently, and you're going to have machloket, chiluk, differences of opinions as to how to apply Jewish law. Now, by the way, I'll talk about this again when we get to the Talmud and what it is. We have to understand, it doesn't mean that you had one school saying, yes, you could light a fire on the Sabbath, and no, you can't. Yes, you can eat pork, and no, you can't. The disputes in the Talmud are almost all on incredibly small things, some of which have no actual ramifications for practical application in Jewish law. Many of them are just arguing about theoretical principles which would never apply in any real situation. Okay, the important point to understand here is, yes, there are disputes, but there are red lines beyond which no mainstream traditional Orthodox Jew, certainly no one at the time of Hillel and Shammai, no one after, goes beyond. All the disputes are on little details, which means on the big details, everyone agrees. It's very important to understand. But we have to also see that this is bad news, because this is the beginning of what's going to be a process that's going to make Judaism that much more complicated and that many more arguments and disagreements, which is always going to be, at this period of time, a symptom of what's going to be the big problem plaguing the Jewish people, disagreement. Yeah?
I mean, isn't it possible that maybe those disagreements that some people may have raised are not in line with what they have thought about the In other words, if someone had said, maybe it was a more fundamental principle question that they had,
You mean you can't eat pork?
Not even necessarily that, but something along a more dramatic nature.
No, we have no reason. There's so many arguments brought down. There's no reason to assume. We see that there are definitely people who deny whole chunks of Judaism and go off and make their own forms of religions, which we'll see later. But no, we have no. You have no reason to assume that. There's so many disputes, Lack of evidence is no evidence of lack. Maybe someone did say such a thing, but there's no reason to assume, based on the vast amount of the sea of information we have in the Talmud, recording all these disputes, that there was any person who ever... We don't see any example of anyone coming up with something that's outrageous, off the wall, breaks with mainstream Judaism. There are people who do that, but not within this chain of transmission. We have no evidence of it. And certainly, I would think that if the rabbis had in their best interest, they could have easily just taken one line and followed all the way through and dumped all disputes. It's a measure of the incredible intellectual integrity of the Jewish people that we allow for dispute, and we record it, and we don't whitewash anything. One of the great features of anything in looking at chronicling Jewish history or Jewish law is the fact that nothing's pushed under the carpet. All the dirty laundry is hung out to dry, so everyone can see it. Okay, and all of the disputes are there, and all the fighting, and all the criticism. So there's no reason to assume that everything is there except for something that's excluded that was too extreme that they just left it out. No matter how extreme it is, we find it in the text. So, okay, So we're going to have the beginning of halachic disputes, which is just part and parcel of all of the disputes that's going to be coming at this time, and it's part and parcel of the general declining spiritual state of the Jewish people, which is, by the way, characterized by a phrase that's very important. It's called Yiridot HaDorot. It's very important to understand. You want to understand how the Jewish people traditionally look at the transmission process. We do not look at it with the arrogance that modern man has often, which is the later we get in history because we have more technology, whatever, everything we do today is better than what was done previously. This is not a Jewish idea of neither history nor spirituality nor Jewish law. We say that in the ancient world, as I mentioned way, way back, ancient man, not primitive, ancient man was spiritually more sophisticated. Ancient man was technologically very sophisticated, even though they may have lacked things like metal tools and electricity. The example I gave was Egypt. People could do things in the ancient world that we can't even do today. Certainly in the realm of spirituality. And in the realm of the transmission process, we say exact opposite. The closer we are to Mount Sinai, and chronologically speaking, the clearer is the transmission process. Now, the whole transmission process of the Jewish people is one of the most amazing aspects of Jewish history. The fact that it's been passed down for thousands of years and has been able to evolve and adapt itself to all kinds of scenarios, yet the basic corpus, the body of what is Jewish law, is there unchanging, is amazing. Okay, but we say the earlier back we go, the clearer it is, and therefore, very important to understand if you want to understand the transmission process, people who live later in history do not have the authority to uproot things said by earlier people. You can go by one of a number of opinions said by earlier sages, but you can't just say, I know better than they did, because you don't. Because our understanding is less clear. That's fundamental to the whole transmission process. So we're going to see when you get to the Mishnah and the Talmud that an Amora, the guys who wrote the Gemara, they can definitely choose an opinion amongst the Tanaim, the guys who wrote the Mishnah, which is earlier, but they can't say, I don't hold by any of those guys, here's my opinion based on my own idea. Because understanding of how Jewish law is applied and how Jewish worldview is derived comes from what's called the chain of transmission. It's passed on. Very important to understand when you want to understand the historical process of transmission. So we say the further away we get from Mount Sinai, the less clear is our understanding of the law. Therefore, the fuzzier it gets around the edges, the more disagreements. Now, you can still apply the law to all modern situations. With that, you can do. But we don't have the authority to uproot things or to dump things. We don't need that anymore. And by the way, we're going to see in history, once you start dumping little things, the big things get dumped also. Okay. The next group of sages that comes after the Zugot, again, we're talking about the line being 10 BCE. It's very important, by the way. This is one of the things that is worth memorizing. It'll help you tremendously when you study Jewish texts to understand who is when. And if you appreciate what they're going through historically, you have a little historical context when these guys are ruling, you'll have a much better appreciation of the miracle of what Jewish law and transmission process is all about. The next group of guys are called the Tanaim. Okay? Now, Tanaim are the guys generally referred to as the Pharisees. Okay, we're talking about the Tzadukim and the Perushim. When you hear the word Pharisees, however, in the context of like the story of Christianity in the New Testament, we're talking about the Tanoim. And of course, obviously, the New Testament paints them as being these evil guys who plot to kill Jesus. Pharisees in the general world has a very negative connotation. Remember, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter? Remember, anyone in the New Testament says is good, from our perspective, is usually bad, and vice versa? So here's a great example. From the Jewish perspective, these are the unsung heroes of the Jewish people. They're going to play a very important role in this whole period of time of Jewish history. From Herod onward through the destruction, they are going to assume the mantle of leadership. And in addition to preserving the transmission process, the big thing they're going to do, which is so important, is hold the Jewish people together. They're going to be the only source of leadership and direction for the Jewish people. And we get the people like Yochanan ben Zakkai, which will be on, tomorrow I'm not going to be here, but on Tuesday, when we talk about Yochanan ben Zakkai and the destruction of the Second Temple, we'll see how important some of these people are in not just the transmission process, but in the physical survival of the Jewish people who make the transmission process possible. Okay, so Tanoim, 10 BCE till 200 thereabouts, of the Common Era, the guy who's right on the border between the Tanoim and the next group of rabbis, the Amoraim, is Yehuda HaNasi, who we're going to talk about in the next class, within the next two classes. Very significant person in Jewish history. The Tanoim all have a little bit of a clue here. You want to know who's a Tana? The Tanoim will all have the title Rebbe. Rebbe Yehuda, Rebbe Yochanan. Now, that's very interesting, because when you're learning Talmud and you hear these guys' names mentioned, you'll be able to place them in a certain period of time in Jewish history, which is from 10 BCE till 200, a 210-year period, which is the period of Roman occupation of Israel. The later guys, the Amorim, who I don't want to get into now, they have the name, they'll have the title Rav. Again, Tana is Aramaic for teacher. These are the guys who ultimately are going to be responsible for putting the Mishnah together during the time of Yehuda Hanasi. We're talking about at the very end of this period of time. So we're talking about from the Zugot. During the Roman period of time, we have the last few of the Zugot, and then going into the period of the Tanaim. So these guys who are all mentioned in the Ethics of the Fathers, if you read in the Ethics of the Fathers, it talks about the whole transmission process, these names will all come up. And then if you understand the history, when we go through the next class or so, and you appreciate how difficult is the circumstances we're living under, and you read Pirkei Avot, and you realize what's going on in terms of Roman authority outside, and what's going on with the Jewish people inside, you'll have a much better appreciation of why they're saying what they're saying. Okay, I think I'm going to stop here, because I want to pick up next class with the Great Revolt itself, which is one of the most significant revolts in the history of the Roman Empire. And a really bloody story, unfortunately, and a tragic event for the Jewish people. So we'll stop here, and on Tuesday, we'll start with the Great Revolt.
This program is part of a series. For the continuation, please insert the next disc.